So I'm curious what your transportation strategy is when it's pouring like this in New York. I mean, we know Nate takes cabs like a true one percenter, but
I take the subway every single day.
How'd you get?
It was not a good cab route.
Subway to express crosstown bus.
Ooh,
yeah,
very Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes, very. All right, let's start this show. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. There is plenty to discuss on today's show. Now that the midterms are behind us, we are going to use the 2018 results to talk about which states are changing and how and what that means for politics going forward. And then we're going to do our first post-midterm Democratic primary draft. Essentially, now that we know what we know, who has the best chance of winning over the Democratic Party in 2020, which is an election year. I don't know if you know, 2020 election year. Keep that on your calendar. And as you, dear listener, may have picked up on, we are doing it all in front of a live audience here at the 92nd Street Y. In the greatest city in the world, New York City. You got to knock off the easy applause lines early. Use it every time. Now, look, this is airing on Monday afternoon, but we are taping this on Friday evening. So listeners, please forgive us for not addressing the 15 different stories that will break between the taping of this show and the airing of this show. But here to make sense of the midterms and to thrill and delight our live audience, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Jody.
Senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hello, Claire. And sickly managing editor Micah Cohen. Say some words.
I'm very sick. I apologize. Like, happened right when the election ended. I barely got here, so please bear with
me. This is a good indication of what priorities Micah's body had. It was like, I'm going to get you through election night, but not to the live show. We'll get through it together. And backstage, by the way, producer and reporter Galen Druk. Give him a round of applause. So as I said, we're going to talk about some of the changing nature of states and some of the changing regions in this country, particularly in light of what we learned last Tuesday night. But let's just check in on where the election stands as we're recording this right now. We are still getting results. This election is not over. So we project, help me out here, Nate, Democrats to win 37 House seats and Republicans to be plus two with Senate. But what's your state of where things stand right now in terms of counting?
If you want to be very precise, I think 37 might be one and a half low.
So we have a lot of, just doing the quick math.
We have a lot of races in lean Democrat that I think we're being a little generous to the Republican by calling lean Democrat instead of likely Democrat. There are like still 4.5 million ballots to be counted in California. Those tend to shift the margin by several points from Republicans toward Democrats. You've already seen that in some of those races, but like that probably will not go well for the GOP. In Arizona, Sinema now has a 1 percentage point lead. It seems like more of the vote. We're nonpartisan, you know, so no cheering for
results.
The audience can do whatever they want.
Can never end. But, you know, she'll probably win. I do not know what's going on in Florida. I do not.
Yeah, you're not alone. Yeah.
I tend not to think that Bill Nelson will win, but I don't know what the fuck's going on in Florida. But it might end up being, you know, GOP minus 38 or 39 House and then probably plus two Senate if they somehow do lose Florida. It would go down to a plus one or the Mississippi runoff. But that's different. I think, like, you know, for Democrats to have won probably Arizona, other states like Montana and Nevada that were declared either early Wednesday morning or late Tuesday night, you know, when we went off air on ABC, it was, I think, 33 was our projection. Now it's 37 or 38, yeah. Right? If you're trying to, like, decide, is this, like, a wave or not, and you're kind of on the fence before, like, I think we are now into wave territory.
Mm-hmm. And so... So to that point, Claire, I mean, we talk about this all the time. There is the results, and then there's the narrative out of those results. Does it feel like maybe because of this stop-start, because of the results are sort of trickling in, that Democrats didn't have a chance to seize like this was a definitive wave narrative?
It's unfortunate that people go to bed at midnight thinking that They want to know if they think they think of it kind of like Christmas, like electoral Christmas, and that everything should be, you know, wrapped up and exciting and done for, and then the next day you move on, which is not really how it works. And I think Twitter throughout election night kind of did a disservice to people who were second screening, because counties come in at different times. The East Coast results come in first. And so people get a very skewed vision of the night, but because they're just honed in and their face is on the paper and they're not thinking about, well, what's going to happen next. And I think even, you know, I don't remember what time we recorded our podcast on election night, but there were still stuff that
like
I think
12:30
that came in afterwards that was surprising and would have changed, I think, the way the tenor of the conversation.
I mean, there was like an hour, and if you saw our model, it was reacting to this. There was an hour when things looked actually a little bit like you might have a repeat of a 2016. So what everyone watched is the states that closed at 6, so you're watching the Kentucky 6 House race in Lexington and Indiana, the Senate race there. And those were two of the worst results of the night for Democrats, where they lost Kentucky 6 by 3 or 4 points and lost Indiana by a lot, by like 7 points or 8 points.
Yeah.
Then you start to watch Florida, the parts in the Eastern time zone. And Florida was probably, after Kentucky and Indiana, the next worst state for Democrats. So, like, you know, we designed a model. We can talk about, like, whether that was overreacting or not. But, like, but there was legitimately a moment where, like, kind of maybe the three worst results for Democrats all kind of happened to be, like, three of the four that report first, along with Virginia.
Yeah, so, and you could feel early on in the night those results starting to, like, affect a narrative, which is silly for that to happen that early. And then, you know, I spent... We wrapped up the live blog at like 2:30.
Two thirty.
And before we wrapped it up, I was like looking, you know, what's the headline in the Wall Street Journal's front page? What's the headline at the Times? And almost all of them had some version of like split decision, which is stupid, really. It's certainly the Republicans are going to keep the Senate, but people are confusing inputs and outputs, where the input was not a split decision. Where the American people are at this moment is super clear. The output, sure, is split, but those are not the same thing.
But if Democrats had lost Arizona and Nevada and Montana.
I do also think that the divided government narrative is A, true, and B, people don't consider, like, I think we've talked a lot about during Obama's administration, the Democrats were at their lowest ebb of power if you were talking state legislature control and governorships. And like, so people don't consider that. And so when you're talking about blue waves and, you know, people aren't taking into consideration the national popular vote for the House, and they're not taking into consideration governorships that are won. They're just thinking about Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. It's kind of like the natural way that I think most people digest the election results.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, I don't think it was a crazy historic blue wave. It wasn't. It was like a pretty normal midterm
rebuke of
the sitting president. You know, I was listening to, I won't name the podcast, but I was listening to like
To other podcasts.
Yeah, I was listening to a left-leaning podcast, and you could kind of like, you could kind of hear them trying to convince themselves that this was like just like a crazy historic night. Look, if you're a Democrat, you should be like happy with how the night went. But some of the governor's races did not go the way they wanted to. It wasn't some historic wave like maybe we saw in 2010. It was a standard rebuke.
Solidly, it was a solidly above average wave.
Yeah, and I will just say, I think the fact, I mean, obviously Florida is still in flux, and Georgia is still in flux, but the idea that those were two governor's races that were freighted with a lot of emotional baggage for Democrats, and that they weren't, I think we were all pretty surprised by the Gillum result, if I can put words in people's mouths, maybe not you.
So let's move on a little bit and take a step back, because I think you're bringing us right to a good chance to sort of get some context about these results. So, you know, we saw some trends from 2016 certainly continue in this election, but we also saw some things revert to the mean, and the map ultimately didn't look all that different from what we expected. It does, however, reflect a country that is changing and dividing in many ways. But I thought we could talk a little bit about states and regions that are moving in different directions politically, and that will obviously have an impact on the electoral map going forward into 2020. So let's just begin with a big, broad question. Claire, maybe you can start here. What, if you think about a regional trend, what was the most significant regional trend we saw on Tuesday night?
Well, I guess the fact that the Midwest was sort of snapping back to pre-2016 proclivities, I mean, I did a talk earlier in the week with someone who said, what's up with the Midwest? They just keep on just changing their minds about things, which was interesting. But I do think, you know, Wisconsin defeating Scott Walker was interesting. I think the fact that I'm going to talk through there was some interesting stuff happening in the Midwest as far as reverting back to a non-Hillary Clinton Democrat, right? The one state that I thought was interesting in its split ticketness was Ohio, yeah. Which
that's a Claire's Ohio Walker, bias.
No, but it is a thing because I do think Ohio might be getting redder and redder, and that Sherrod Brown has just been a fixture in the state for a long time, whose brand of populism has been steadfast and fits well with the Trump era. Makes sense that he won in the Senate, and maybe I don't know what's going on. Maybe Cordray wasn't a strong candidate, but I also find the argument compelling that there are a lot of non-college educated whites in Ohio. There's an Appalachian flavor to the state in certain parts. You've got like the Northeast Ohio, which has the Obama-Trump voter. And so it is a state that I keep on thinking about. I thought it was an interesting result on Tuesday. And I think it's part of it is home state interest. But I do think part of it talks to the weird shift that the Midwest is going.
It is nice to be from the most interesting state in the union, though. You know, how convenient. Let's get each of you to kind of riff on your regional trend, and then we'll go into specific state by state. But Micah?
Yeah, I'd accuse Claire of a Midwestern bias, but I think she's right that it was the most interesting region. I guess maybe I'd look at it a little differently. I sound ridiculous.
sound great.
I'd look at it a little differently. You've all probably heard this by now, but like Democrats really won the House through the suburbs. And what was particularly interesting is that, so in 2016, you see well-educated suburbs, high-income suburbs that traditionally were Republican shift towards Democrats and shift towards Clinton. At the same time, less educated, lower-income, like more rural areas that traditionally were Democratic shift towards Trump. This year, we saw Democrats maintain their gains in the high-education, high-income suburbs, but, and this was exemplified in the Midwest, you know, those lower education, maybe more exurban areas, snap back a little bit, to use Claire's words. So that is sort of the story of the night, and I think why sort of everything lined up to form.
I thought Dave Wasserman from the Cook Political Report has an interesting theory about, I think something, this is me, don't quote me on this, but like 70% of the Democrats' wins were in districts that had Whole Foods in
them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about Whole Foods later, but yes.
I actually think it is funny, but there is also something I find a little, let's step back a little bit from the horse raciness of it. You know, we've talked a lot since 2016 about the education divide in the country, about the urban-rural divide. And I do think, like, the idea that Whole Foods exemplifying this, like, suburban monoculture, this class thing that we don't talk about very well, where I don't think a lot of Americans live next to, you know, if you're college educated, you don't live next to someone who's not college educated. There isn't a lot of, we've talked about this a lot, you know, there's not, people do, not just mix with people who are of the same political party, but they are not mixing classes. And I think in America, we don't like to talk about that a lot, that we have classes, but we do. You know, people say, oh, the Brits have the real class problem. But, like, I think the past two election cycles have really brought it, you know, to the fore that, like, this is a class thing. And the Whole Foods theory is flipped in some ways, but also very telling that, like, people with college educations eat differently than people without college educations. And I think that that's something that is, I mean, it's politics, but it's our culture, and it's something to think about.
And on the Whole Foods thing, I mean, Whole Foods does, this is true, decide where to put their stores, and one of their metrics is education level.
Yeah.
And so it's not like there's a direct connection between these two trends, but they're both actually kind of tied to the same thing, which is education levels and concentration of that. So Nate, real quick, you know, regional trend laid out there. You can steal the Midwest from your two colleagues if you want.
This is a layup because no one's brought up Texas yet.
Okay.
Shifts in his chair.
Bring up Texas. Go for it.
Texas is not quite a swing state yet, but it's in the next in line to be a swing state, I think, finally.
And more next in line than it was on the day before Election Day?
So Beto O'Rourke beat his polls by a little bit. He was down 5 and won, lost rather, by 2.5. He won by -2.
Is that convincing to you Democrats in the audience?
in the House, you actually saw like a lot of races that were not thought to be close at all, that no one was really tracking, where you saw the Democrat lose by like only 5 or 6 points. So I think you'll see Democrats target those races in 2020 and beyond. The turnout was like, I think, was it like actually higher than presidential year turnout, or like very close to it? I mean, it's like, it's pretty crazy, because that state, when everyone votes, is a lot different than the traditional Texas electorate. So again, I'm not saying it's in a swing state category yet. I'm saying it's in that Arizona, Georgia, maybe North Carolina category, where Democrats can compete there in a good year. And in the long run, if the upper Midwest goes bye-bye for Democrats, then they'll have to like find ways to actually win occasionally states like those.
We'll come back to that, and maybe we'll jump right back into Texas and the Sun Belt. But first, I have to take a break and tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. 50% of corporate real estate is underutilized. WeWork is 2.5 times more efficient with space than a typical office, freeing up room for new people, businesses, and jobs. Increased density and efficient use of real estate can reduce a city's carbon footprint, unlocking space in neighborhoods without requiring additional construction. With 260,000 members across nearly 300 locations in 23 countries, WeWork partners with companies of all sizes to provide the space they need when and how they need it. Flexible terms, beautiful spaces, dynamic communities, and a range of privacy and design options create the workspace that's perfect for you today and changes with you tomorrow. Visit WeWork.com to find a location near you and learn more about office space products and plans to fit your business's evolving needs. Once again, that's WeWork.com. That will happen again later in the show. Okay, but we're back, and let's pick it back up there on, you know, Mike, if you want to react to what Nate was saying, and then also just a larger notion of the Sun Belt and thinking of this kind of region of states.
Yeah, I was going to ask, if you're, let's say you're a Democrat running in 2020, and you're like one electoral vote short, and you can run in either Ohio or Texas, that's a state you need to invest in and try to win. Which do you go for?
He's going to say Texas.
Texas.
Really?
Texas.
I mean, Ohio is like going the way of Missouri, I think. Ohio is a really bad state for Democrats, whereas even Iowa like bounced back in the House, although they lost the governorship there. But Ohio...
Why did Brown win and Cordray didn't? Like, I'm not... It's not.
I mean, Brown's race was closer than you would have thought, too.
Yeah.
I think he only won by 7 or 8 or something.
So, Claire, your state is no longer a swing state?
I think it's definitely trending red. I mean, I do think Brown has been there for a long time. Brown is a populist. Like, we really can't lose sight of that. Cordray could be pretty easily tied to Elizabeth Warren, to Washington Democrats. He was running against Mike DeWine. I don't think Mike DeWine was a particularly great candidate either, but Mike DeWine is a really well-known name in the state, too. It wasn't a great environment for a Democrat who wasn't Sherrod Brown.
So can I just sort of put a circle around this? Because I feel like for my entire political life, Ohio has been the swing state, and it's been kind of like such a obsession. And we're saying that potentially now moving forward, it's solidly red and people should look elsewhere for Democratic votes.
I mean, as someone from Michigan, I've always thought Ohio is a little bit overrated.
Fair enough.
Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, that's the real swing states, Jody.
Uh-huh.
No, but I do think that Ohio is a state that was really affected by the 2008 financial crash. And I think, you know, so let's go back to a lot of non-college educated white men, Trump's base. The fact that, you know, Trump and Sanders really resonated in Ohio, I think in part because people do distrust institutions there. They distrust D.C., right? So the idea of like blowing it all up in the Trumpian mold is good to them. And I think, like, from a cultural point of view, yeah, you see a lot of Ohio voters saying the Democrats aren't our bag. Now, I will also say, what if Tim Ryan, my perennial 2020 draft pick, Youngstown congressman, now, he's someone who's, like, I think an avatar for the kind of Ohio Democrat who does well, but he's also got a pretty, like, populist background going, which, you know, I don't know how that's going to play going forward.
I think that it's even a question whether you would do Ohio or Texas is amazing that we've come that far. But that we've come that far is why you should, you know, we,
I mean, you,
in four
but it's
years,
also,
it
you
could
would definitely
back.
Do Arizona before Ohio.
And we should talk about why a little bit, because there is this, I mean, let's move away from white men in Ohio to the fact that in Texas and Arizona, I mean, the thing with the Latino vote is that you're going to get a lot of people who are second generation, third generation, who are aging into voting. So I think that's a big thing about California, Texas, Arizona, those states. A lot of the Latino populations of those states cannot vote right now, but in, you know, they're aging into it, or they're, you know, generationally aging into voting. And I think that's why those states come on the map for Democrats.
But the map just feels, like you said, Nate, oh, you definitely go with Arizona. The map just feels more unsettled right now than it has in a while. Or I don't, maybe it's always unsettled. But where I don't have a good read on what the swing states will necessarily be in 2020, where it probably will depend a lot on who the candidates are and what their personalities are and what they're running. If it's Joe Biden or Tim Ryan versus Kamala Harris, then maybe you have a whole different set of swing states. Mm-hmm. But that's different. You know, the past couple cycles, to Jody's point, you could predict pretty easily which states the race would come down to.
Can we talk a little bit about the Sun Belt? We've used that term a number of times. Nate, do you want to sort of take a crack at defining which states are in that? I don't know where this came from.
Map.
It gets weirder and weirder the further you go from bottom right to top left. But nevertheless,
who made this, Galen?
I think Galen found this on the internet. I don't know. But
what's
nevertheless,
the Jell-O thing?
Sun Belt is the one that seems reasonable here to talk about.
The Sun Belt is like the entire country.
Well, it's sunny down there, Micah. So referring to this slide or not, Nate, take a crack at defining what we say when we talk about the Sun Belt, what kind of voters we're talking about, and if there's a path there.
So the sun is a giant star.
Okay. Yes, okay. I take some notes here.
And it's hot. So okay. If you have a lot of sun, then these states are hot. No, I mean, there are states in the south, both the south-south and like the southwest. They tend to not have a lot of people who are there natively.
I thought you were just going to stop there. Yeah. There are states in the south.
Yeah.
No, but look.
There are states people want to move to.
They have old conservative religious white people plus black and or Hispanic and or Asian voters in increasing numbers plus now more people moving from the north, both old people to retire and then like tech sector workers in Texas and North Carolina and Georgia and states like that. So they're changing a lot. Mm-hmm. They have historically been states that lead to a lot of frustration for the Democrats in the same way that kind of New Jersey is frustrating for Republicans, where like it's kind of on the fringe of a swing state and maybe it isn't quite. You know, I'm still not totally sure that there's been a breakthrough per se, right? It can definitely be true that like, look, if Trump becomes really, really, really unpopular and the Democrat wins the popular vote by 7 points nationally, they'll probably win Arizona. And I would think Texas and Georgia would be toss-ups, right? If you're at the tipping point, though, where it's a 1 or 2 point race, then I'm not sure they're there yet. And I think sometimes that temptation for Democrats can, you know, it would be very fun if you're a Democrat to, like, paint these, I mean, they're giant states, right? To paint, like, these giant states a different color.
Yellow or orange.
Finger painting.
But the easiest path for a Democrat to win the White House is still by holding the upper Midwest.
Okay.
I think.
So in 2016... Democrats thought it was a breakthrough year for the Sun Belt. I mean, what did we learn from that? And do we have any indication that it will change by 2020?
Well, they did put some resources in Arizona that looking back.
And Clinton did fine there. She lost by, what, 2 or 3 points?
Yeah, she might have won Arizona in the pre-Comey universe.
Yeah, sure.
It was not that far from the tipping point.
Right.
But the 2016 election, I don't think we know yet to what extent that was an outlier and to what extent it was sort of the new normal, continuation of trends we're already seeing. Where if the main dividing lines in American politics are race and education, then I think you would expect the Sun Belt to become more competitive, right?
And she was putting resources in Arizona and Georgia specifically, if I'm remembering.
Yes.
So those were her states that she thought had give.
But there's still, to Nate's point, there's still just so many electoral college votes in the Midwest. What did you call it?
The Northern Path?
Yeah.
Something is weird about that. There's like an Italian political party called the Northern League, I think.
Yeah.
It's like bad news.
So maybe we won't use that one going forward.
Yeah.
So let's start to wrap up a little bit here. And I just want to ask, so how much should Democrats focus their energy, going back to this question of suburbs versus rural parts of the country versus cities, on well-to-do suburbs? I mean, we've been talking regionally, we've been talking at the state level. Obviously, that matters because that's how the Electoral College is structured. But should we really be talking about pockets of voters within those states that are being targeted? And even more specifically, should we be talking about a suburban strategy? Is that where Democrats are really going to find their voters?
The women.
Say that again?
No, I'm serious. So, yeah.
Sorry, what was that?
I said the women.
The women, yes.
I believe it's a play. If you are being a political strategist, I mean, earlier I went on a rant about class in America, but if you want to win votes, that's a college-educated suburban populations are places where people are more likely to vote, and college-educated white women are the moving demographic of the past 2 years. So, yeah, I think you do target suburbs specifically within those states if you're a Democrat.
If I'm a Democrat, though, to me what I have to figure out is a Democrat going to win a Senate race in Indiana anytime in the near future or in...
If Joe Donnelly can't do it.
So that's the thing is, like, do you target suburbs or do you target college-educated women or do you target women or non-college-educated women? White women, I think, split 49-49 this year, which is an improvement for Democrats over 2016. I think part of the reason they did well.
Non-college-educated women.
No, just white women
white
overall.
Women. And non-college-educated white women moved more towards the Democrats this election by a little bit.
Yes, but still voted Republican.
Still voted Republican.
So if you're the Democratic Party and you want to be a national party that competes in, like, the prairie states or in, you know, I mean, look, there's always exceptions, right? Democrats just want a governor's race in Kansas. But, again, it feels unsettled to me where I think you need to make gains among non-college-educated women and not just college-educated women to compete in some of these redder, more rural areas.
But we're writing off men.
You're acting like there's no women in the prairie, right? It is, it is 51% of the population pretty much everywhere.
Well, but they're not winning the women in those areas.
Yeah.
There are women in the prairie, I do admit.
Thank you. I was waiting for you to jump in.
Have you read Laura Ingalls Wilder?
One last thing, and Nate, maybe I can ask you this, and this will sort of segue into our next segment. So actually, can we go back to the electoral map of 2020 that Nate whipped up? Yeah. So it just occurs to me that a lot of the states that we just rattled off and a lot of the regions that we rattled off don't match very closely with the early primary states. And I know we talk about this every election, but does it feel like there's even more of a disconnect between the primary path that a candidate has to take and then the electoral regional path that they'll have to take in order to actually win?
I think Nevada moved up, right? A little bit?
California moved up, which is right. Quite relevant. I mean, for Democrats, it seems to matter a little bit less than for Republicans. Where for Republicans, you have this very weird thing where, like, Iowa, which has one of the most conservative electorates, and New Hampshire, which has maybe the most liberal, are back-to-back, and that, like, actually, I think, lends the GOP primary to careen all over the place a little bit more. You know, in Iowa, the caucus electorate is traditionally activist and pretty liberal, a certain type of liberal, but liberal. New Hampshire is a little bit different. You know, I mean, they're both very white. I think that needs to be said.
Yeah.
So South Carolina and Nevada moving up, it's part of the impetus behind that. But I don't know. I think the order of the states doesn't matter as much for Democrats as for Republicans, although it probably does give, like, a little bit of a leg up to a Midwestern candidate. You still see in Iowa that Midwesterners tend to overperform and Northeasterners overperform in New Hampshire a little bit. I mean, to some extent, it's a little circular, right? It's like we are part of the media now, part of the mainstream media, it or not.
Never. Come on. We're not.
Nate admits it.
We are owned by ABC News. They're one of the, we're part of the mainstream media. And so it's like if we treat New Hampshire and Iowa as being really important and South Carolina and Nevada as being only marginally important, right, then you kind of shape perceptions a little bit. That's kind of how things are currently, but we'll see. I mean, we're going to talk about the Democratic primary in a moment, I guess.
This is why I brought us here, is to perfectly segue into our next segment, where we are going to talk about the 2020 Democratic primary and the people who have a path to winning that. We will do that in a second. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast. You can listen wherever you want, whenever you want, whenever it's convenient for you. Did you know that you can get postage on demand? All you need is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can access all the services of the post office right from your desk, buy and print real U.S. postage for any letter or any package, all available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. Right now, use the code ELECTIONS for this special offer, a four-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ELECTIONS. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are approaching and you may be thinking about how you're going to save some extra money. Well, here's a way that maybe you haven't thought of. Consolidate your high interest credit card balances to a lower rate and save with Lightstream. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 6.14% APR with autopay. Compare that to the national average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. National average is over 19% APR. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can get your money as soon as the day that you apply. Go right now to lightstream.com/538. Lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. Thank you.
Rowdy
That's
crowd.
It. Done.
I think it's very peaceful.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
What's that?
The acoustics are such that we can hear everything. It's amazing.
Yeah, we heard every one of those conversations. Okay, we're back and let's do it. It's time for our first 2020 primary draft since the midterms. We've done this a number of times on the site. We've done it once on the podcast before, but we're going to see how much our idea of which candidates Democrats will rally around has changed, particularly since the midterms. The question, we always squabble about this. So these are the parameters. You ready? The question we're trying to answer is, who is most likely to win the 2020 Democratic presidential primary? When you pick your draftee, I would be very interested to hear, you know, if that's changed from the past, and in particular, again, whether that's changed because of the election on Tuesday night. Everyone can jump in and push back and talk some shit if you want. It's fine. And the audience, you'll be able to follow along on the screen behind us. We have a nice little grid, and I think we figured out the technology to write in the names as we select them. We'll see. We're radio folks, not a.
I like the little flags in the corner.
Yeah, this is really nice. Yeah. All right, let's get that grid up. Our draft is going to be a snake draft, and Claire is going first. We've just decided. It's
cool.
Going to go Claire, Nate, Micah, then Micah again. We're snaking back.
Oh, actually, I'll take
draft.
That. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
All right, so Claire, who is the number one overall choice in our 2020 Democratic primary draft?
Bad pick. I am sticking with my last first-round choice of Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren. Okay, there it is.
They don't like that pick.
And I'll just ask, I'll probably ask this with every pick. Did anything on Tuesday night change this or not change it or solidify it? Or?
Not really. I think one of these two will probably pick Joe Biden. I don't necessarily see him.
Which one of these two?
Probably Micah.
No.
Look. I like this.
Now I can't pick him.
I like these mind games you're playing, Claire.
Well, let me give you the reasons why I think Warren still remains compelling. I think probably this crowd is pretty sensitive maybe to the ad she released about her Native American heritage. I do think that that was a misstep, but I continue to think she's a woman. She is a college-educated white woman. See aforementioned demographic that I was talking about. She is not, I mean, in some ways you could call her sort of like, she's almost like she was the philosopher king choice for a while. She didn't want to be in politics. She was the policy wonk. She was the law professor. She has these sort of progressive credentials while also saying, I love capitalism, right? That's her thing. She doesn't want anyone to paint her as a democratic socialist. She has a pretty good personal biography. I still think she's a solid choice.
All right. Nate Silver, your choice.
Trying to figure out if I should be tactical or not here, but I'm going to be the honest pick, and I'm going to go with Joe Biden.
Joe Biden. Tactical would have been thinking that Biden is going to fall to the
that
second
Micah,
round.
That Micah, having said that he wouldn't pick Biden, I would get him at five.
Okay,
right?
So, and do you remember, I don't know the historical trends here, but you've been picking Biden pretty high.
I'm picking Biden a lot.
Pretty consistently. So nothing from Tuesday changed that for you?
Not particularly.
I'm looking at my list for what it's worth.
Yeah, Mike is just bored and he's checking the end.
No, but look, I don't feel well, so I can't remember anything. Keep going, Nate.
I think you have a lot of candidates competing to be the new emerging brand in the party. I think you have a lot of candidates that are playing to the left and not the moderate left or the center or whatever. He is like way ahead in polls when you see them.
Mm-hmm.
He seems at least mildly interested in running. It seems like other candidates that are in that tier are afraid of him running and therefore being tentative, and so there are some signals there. I mean, he was the former vice president.
We know.
He is very popular with...
He's like 200
with large
years
parts
old.
Of the party, with African American. So the one-term pledge, dude.
The one-term pledge. Wow.
So,
okay.
So your pick is...
Who's his VP?
I'm not going to reveal a VP because that might reveal who my next choice would be.
Okay.
But Biden plus the one-term pledge plus some VP who is not a white dude.
Kamala.
So in 2008, when McCain was losing by a lot, he reportedly considered picking
Bill Lieberman
as his VP and taking a one-term pledge. And the reason they didn't do it is because they realized you're like a lame duck instantly. So I don't think that's a viable play. But good pick either way.
All right, Micah. Micah, you get two here.
I got two.
But it matters which one you pick first.
It doesn't,
though.
In the
snake. It does for psychological reasons.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So my first pick is going to be...
Bad pick.
Kamala Harris.
Okay.
And my next pick will be Amy Klobuchar.
So, Klobuchar, I told you before this, I said I know whose stock rose the most since the last time we did this because of Tuesday night. Is that that's a reflection of Tuesday night, or is this something larger?
I think that she's a really good politician. I think you saw that in the Kavanaugh hearings, that whole conversation we had about the Midwest. She plays right into that. She won like 60% of the vote on Tuesday. So I actually think in one of our earlier drafts, I picked her. Someone else picked her. So that's just to say she's – I'm not sure stocks go up that much or down based on Tuesday. But like I bet the media does cover her more as a result of Tuesday.
Yeah.
So
we're also the mainstream media now. And we're talking about her on a
mid-tier
politics podcast. So we will clearly raise her profiles considerably.
And then Kamala Harris is kind of similar rationale, obviously. Yeah. It's like, where is there energy in the party? Who's going to get people excited? Who's less than 200 years old? You know.
My mother told me that we're ageist.
On the podcast.
Yeah.
So I'm actually very sensitive to that, but it's just like you're running
a
campaign.
She only recently started listening, though. So yeah.
He's also, he is also old.
It's like it.
And it's good of your mom to be able to figure out the technology to listen to the podcast.
Oh, don't talk about my mom, Jody. Don't talk about my mom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nate Silver, you're up next.
So we're nearing the end of the top tier here.
We sure are. I'm looking at my list.
A member newly elevated to the top tier is Beto O'Rourke.
Okay. Oh, my God. Bad pick.
Why? No. Why bad pick? Why not?
It worked out perfectly for him. Where he
it's a good pick.
If he had won, disaster for him running for president.
He's so happy with his results.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Two and a half points. Democrats have a good night overall, but not a guy. It's like perfect for him, right?
Yeah, good pick.
And also, like, when I was reached, I thought, okay, there are going to be like lots of stupid articles speculating about Beto running. There are actually some well-reported articles that kind of say he's being urged to run. And because there's been so much news, people have not paid attention to that, which is hard. People click on Beto stuff more than anything else, I think.
Except for at the
ballot
box.
But he did quite respectably well. He's been a member of Congress for a long time. He raised a lot of money. I mean, you know, there are Beto yard signs in states where he's not running. So
yeah, no. Yeah.
I don't know where for 2020.
I don't know where I rank him in that top five or the top six, but I do think if he ran, he'd be serious.
And he's not your pair with Joe Biden as a VP pick, is he? You had someone else in mind?
I mean,
no,
that would be a little bit
Harris.
Like, no, I think Biden Harris or something.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Claire, you're up.
So I think there's only a couple people left at the top tier, and I'm going to go with Kirsten Gillibrand.
Okay.
I think she has some problems, which is why I think she's gone lower in the draft. Number one, I think she's got a donor base problem. She got some blowback after the Al Franken stuff, specifically from, frankly, people who are Democratic donors in Franken's demographic. So I think she probably is having a little bit of problems there. But to go to just, you know, what her electoral attractiveness is. A woman. I mean, she's a real... I wrote a piece about this, and some people took it the wrong way. She's a real political animal, and I think she, like, senses the direction of the party. I don't think I have to tell the hometown audience this, but Not so long ago, Kirsten Gillibrand was quite a conservative Democrat.
Yeah.
She now wants to abolish ICE. She's just placed herself in a particular, if we're going to go back to like 2015, 2016 era, talking about politics and talking about lanes and what lane people go in the primary, I would call her, she's angling for the progressive lane, and probably, again, someone who appeals to that white college woman demographic.
Claire, is there any part of you that's a little worried that your first two picks are both regionally grouped, Northeast?
Look who's in the White House. I mean, I think that maybe people would have thought it was crazy a decade ago that so many Northeastern politicians were taken so seriously, but the gravitational pull, for whatever reason, is to politicians from this region. I don't know why.
You have the next pick, Snake.
Yeah, because I was...
We're snaking.
I forgot about that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You just want out? You can pass, I guess.
Okay.
You can't pass.
So, okay, I'm going with the last of the top tier, which is Cory Booker.
Okay. And completing your Northeast.
That's why I don't think he's going to win.
Yeah.
We got like five
Please
people
clap.
Applauded. Yeah.
I think Booker. Okay, no, but like, let's take Booker seriously. I think.
Jesus. If that's a laugh line.
I just start watching Game of Thrones, and there's a line that's like, anybody who has to say that you're a king is not a king. Anybody is like, let's take Cory Booker seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He...
That was like not a sentence what I just said there.
I think a lot of... I think he has a certain kind of handle on retail politics. I think some people find it a little gooberish, but he did used to have that kind of reputation for being the people's mayor in Newark. If Democrats were excited about Andrew Gillum as a black progressive who could turn out a base of voters that came out for Barack Obama and then stayed home during Hillary Clinton's election, Cory Booker is a person who could have the potential to attract those voters. But yeah, I think he's a little bit, there's something sort of ineffable about his, whether you like him or dislike him. So that's, I think, why he's a little bit lower down in the top tier.
I just, for some reason, continue to think in every draft you guys do, he's undervalued. I don't know. For some reason, I just think I could see him finding a lane. But
there are people who think that, but I don't really understand.
Yeah, there's one on stage. And then there's people who actually know what they're talking about. Go ahead, Mike.
No, I think, look, the ability to excite and turn out black voters in a Democratic primary is invaluable. You know, they are the base of the Democratic Party. And in a general election...
Are you sure he'd do that?
I'm not sure. I didn't pick him. but my biggest... The reason I tend not to pick him is, you know, I think you can go at him pretty hard for having ties to Wall Street. One of our writers pointed out to me that, like, I think it is hard if you're coming from outside the system and you're in New Jersey to not have ties to Wall Street.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's also going pretty hard on trying to be preemptively... I believe he's one of the people who is putting forth a universal employment program. So he's trying to trying to balance that out a little bit. But I agree with you that he has that kind of hanging
around. I mean, of the three people on this list that were involved in the Kavanaugh hearings, he was the least effective of the three.
That's true. Because he came off as grandstanding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Nate, you're up. You have Biden so far and Beto O'Rourke so far.
Freaking Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders, there he is. Okay. So
you have the number one pick.
You are who you are. You've consistently picked, you know, this group, but you've often picked Bernie much earlier. I think there's been times when Bernie's been your number one overall pick. So were you just knew that he would drop, or there's something that's going on here?
Yeah. He was the runner-up last time. He seems to want to run. He has a good organization.
He has a B in his name, which is clearly a trend here.
He's second or third in the polls, which is actually not great because he should probably be first given that he was runner-up last time. It seems like Elizabeth Warren is trying to preempt his path, which is also not great for him. But that's why, despite obvious possibilities, he's the eighth pick and not the number one pick. But for an eight pick, I think that's a very valuable pick.
Okay. So we're going to do one more round up here. So each of you will have four, but we got to cruise through it. So, Mikey, you're going to make two picks. Then Nate's going to go, and then Claire is going to finish us off with her final pick. If you can even come up with this many people.
I got to look at my list.
Oh, we can.
Yeah, I mean, there are people. We're at a point now where it's kind of plateaus. But I'm gonna take a risk, and I'm going to pick Andrew Gillum.
Okay. Why not? possible value late in the draft?
Yeah, it's late draft value. No, really good campaigner. I just don't think, you know, winning by half a point in Florida versus losing by half a point in Florida matters a lot to who governs Florida.
But that's a very 538 thing to say, that winning by half a point and losing by half a point are basically the same. But to the world, one's winning and one's losing.
I agree with that. I'm just saying, if we're looking for signal of how good a politician someone mm-hmm. is, right. I don't think that half a point makes much a difference.
He's also been doing it for a while. Like, people, I mean, I know there's a whole narrative about how he's an outsider, but it's like, he actually wasn't that much.
You get another pick here.
I'll go with, some Midwestern white
don't
guy.
Don't look for us for help.
I'll go with John Hickenlooper.
Okay. Definition of the Midwest, but yes.
The plains.
Good beer.
Anything between the coasts.
Maybe. You're just trying to foreskill and write Hickenlooper.
Hickenlooper, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm looking at the online betting odds. And
hold on. Yeah. You wanna?
I want to share something interesting, which is that they have Ocasio-Cortez listed.
Uh-huh.
She can't even
who's
run.
Not yet 35 years old.
Look. The Scottish teams aren't known for their research
right now, frankly. I mean, there is a drop-off after 9 or 10.
Yes, we've noticed. Go ahead, Nate. Yep.
I'm going to make a pick that I kind of hate. can I really make this pick?
Yeah, do it.
Do it.
Bloomberg.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
No way. We do this.
That is actually such a
bad. We do this
pick.
Every time. People convince
it's
themselves that Bloomberg
pick.
Can do it.
It's a bad
it's not
pick.
But they're
happen.
All bad picks. And of the bad picks, he has billions of dollars.
No joke. When I took a Uber after the live blog home, and the driver asked me if Bloomberg was going to run in 2020.
Yeah. So we have.
if I'm Tom Friedman.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that
Tom Friedman.
He dropped a lot of money in those House and Senate races late. And, like, you know, all indications are that he is serious about running. I think concerned about whether Biden would run. He is.
No. All indications are that he likes people saying all indications are he's serious.
No. He is serious about running.
We'll see.
I mean, it's not like that subtle if you read the trade press. I think he's worried about
being
blocked by.
We've been down this before with him several times. Claire.
Well, I'm going to make an original bad pick.
Okay.
Pete Buttigieg.
Ooh.
He is a Midwestern mayor. Therefore, he has no.
Watch Galen open a tab in Google. Go on, Galen, you can do this. What is it, Buttigieg?
I would have picked him. Can you spell it?
I believe it's Buttigieg.
Okay.
Wow.
Is that correct? Anyone know this for sure?
That looks right. Yeah, sure.
Look, I like that everyone in the last column has two letters in a row in their name. That's nice.
Anyway, Pete Buttigieg is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. The reason why I pick him is, one, I think he has ambitions for it. He tried to and failed in his attempt to run for DNC chair, but it was an interesting campaign. He is gay. He is an Army vet. I believe he is a former Rhodes Scholar. But also, I think kind of crucially, he doesn't have a national record. And that's something that helped Trump. And I think that that is an interesting thing, especially when you're talking to an electorate that is pissed with D.C. Buttigieg is kind of an outsider, but also someone who has experience. He is from Indiana, which is a red state, but he's a Democrat. You know, he's in a blue spot, yeah, blue mm-hmm. island. But yeah, I think he's like an interesting up-and-coming person.
Both research and like recent history back up what Claire said about having like a fuzzy record where people can't pin you down. So Trump, or just think about Obama. Right. Obama didn't have a long record. It's like a huge advantage in a primary. Claire, I cannot believe you didn't pick Tim Ryan, though.
I know.
You let him go.
I let him go.
Okay, one more pick.
All right. No, we're done.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank God.
Can I just to say this name out loud? It's never come up, but I just want to say it into a microphone.
Bad pick.
Yeah. Stephen Colbert.
Why?
What?
Why not? Look, I mean, we're all the way at the end
Wait,
here.
Wait, Jody, are you just trying to start something?
A little bit, but also, why not? If we're going like really wild, why
what
not?
If we
but
have people, like a.
If we're gonna go like celebrity picks,
sure.
I think we go.
Let's do a celebrity round.
I think we go Oprah. I think we go The Rock.
I think if Michelle Obama ran, she would win.
Yeah, she would win.
She would win. She's not going to run, though.
What if we had, like, a 100-round draft for charity or something?
Okay.
But I would take The Rock
Pity the charity.
Over Colbert.
Yeah, you would take The Rock over Colbert.
For
Is
sure.
there any celebrity you would take not over Colbert?
No, I mean, he's clearly engaged in these issues. Yeah. Look, at this point, we can't laugh anybody off, right? We tried that
like
once.
You just did.
Yeah.
And it was me. Yeah. Okay. Take a mental picture of this. We will continue to do this.
Wait, who won?
Oh, who won? Yes, let's do an audience applause. Okay.
Oh, no.
So, who thinks that Claire Malone won in terms of, you know, the most viable collection of candidates? Who thinks that Nate Silver won?
You know.
What?
He clearly didn't. By
who
the
would
way.
Have applauded just for whoever had Bernie Sanders on their list?
Okay. No, I think it's Beto.
And who thinks? Oh, maybe Beto. Who thinks Micah Cohen won?
I think he actually.
What?
Okay.
Oh, yeah. All right, there we go. All right, that brings us to the end of the show. That's a wrap. Thank you, Nate Silver.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire Malone.
Thanks, Jody.
Micah Cohen, you are a trooper, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And more importantly, thanks to all of you who joined us at the 92nd Street Y tonight. My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. A special thanks to everyone who helped make this live show possible. Vanessa Diaz, Stephanie Roos, Jennifer Schitzman, and the whole team at the 92nd Street Y. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating in the Apple Podcast Store or just tell someone about the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.